Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report Look Ahead podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Later in the program, what to expect to hear from Navy leaders at this week's Sea Aerospace Conference and Trade Show from the hosts of our Cavas Ships podcast, Chris Cavas and Chris Cervello. But first, my good friend Byron Callen of the independent Washington research firm Capital Alpha Partners with a look at the week ahead and whatever else is on his mind. Byron, hope you guys had a great weekend and thanks so much for joining us.
We had a wonderful weekend, Vago. It's always great to be on.
Always a pleasure, and indeed looking forward to seeing you today and tomorrow. We are recording this in advance of the show. But before we get started, a word from today's sponsor. Join HII at the Navy League Sea Aerospace Conference and Trade Show at the Gaylord National Convention Center, April 8th through 10. HII is committed to delivering the platforms and technologies from aircraft carriers and Flight 3 destroyers to C5ISR and live virtual constructive solutions that create the advantage for their customers as they protect peace and freedom around the world. HII booth 1323. Byron, great notes as always. Let's very quickly review the key themes from your geopolitics note, in particular on Friday. You spanned the gamut from, you know, why Haiti is important and how to think about it to the Ukraine war, Congress's pending supplemental, and we'll see when Congress gets back into town next week whether there's any progress on that. NATO's $100 billion support plan for Ukraine, all the way to Israel. Walk us through, how to think about each of these things from the perspective of the audience.
Well, you know, what I was really pivoting off, Vago, was just the simple fact that large U.S. defense stocks have not done well so far in 2024. And yet, you know, there's been this constant drumbeat of the world is a more dangerous place, which I agree with. But, you know, some of the things that are happening, they haven't registered, inflections for U.S. defense spending plans. You know, if anything, the FY25 budget came out, you know, it's in line with the budget caps. We're, you know, on the cusp of a full week of oversight hearings on the budget release. And it's just, it's hard to see where the incremental change is going to come from. Now, I mentioned Haiti just because there was actually a Chatham House event that was kind of interesting on, you know, really what's going on there. Just a reminder, you know, it's a country with 16 million people. You know, they've got a police force, or what's left of the police force, that is a fraction of the New York City police force, you know, in a country that's basically devolved into kind of warlordism, gang rulership, you know. And that may yet have security implications for the United States. You know, the amount of money that had been pledged to help Haiti kind of right its ship had been deemed, you know, just a pittance for what really needs to be done there. Right. You know, if there's a big refugee movement out of Haiti, you know, how could that play into the 2024 election? You know, there's some irony that some of the states that might be most directly affected by a refugee flow are the ones where a lot of the guns are flowing from into Haiti. Louisiana, Florida, and Georgia were called out during the Chatham House call because they've got fairly, you know, liberal attitudes towards, you know, the sale and ownership of some pretty advanced firearms. And I can speak as myself as a gun owner, you know, it can be easy to buy, you know, military grade weapons in those countries, so in those states. So, you know, how that impacts U.S. defense spending, not directly, but, you know, is it another demand on fiscal resources for military assistance, you know, to whatever troops are sent to eventually help restore order in Haiti? I just don't know, you know, but it's just something to kind of keep an eye on, at least out of the corner of your eye, if right. You think about defense and the pressures on defense spending.
And real quick, your sense on the supplemental, whether we get there, NATO's $100 billion fund and then Israel, where there are growing calls, even among some of the strongest supporters of Israel for, you know, potentially, you know, impacts on arms exports, as we heard from Sash on the weekend business roundtable, right? UK considering arms embargo on Israel.
Question marks on all three, Vago. I mean, you know, last week it looked like there might have been some movement by Speaker Johnson on coming up with, quote unquote, you know, kind of an innovative new security spending package. Let's see what this week holds. The $100 billion fund is kind of interesting, but you've got to get all NATO members to agree to that. And there was an election outcome, I believe, in Slovakia that had returned a pro-Putin candidate. So, can NATO agree on something like that? Or are we going to see, Hungary, Slovakia, maybe some of the other members push back on it? And of course, it's got to be filtered through what happens in the US 2024 election. So, there's a lot, and the Japan, Philippine, what may be an agreement with Japan and the Philippines is kind of an intriguing development in the Indo-Pacific as well too. It again would complicate Chinese defense planning, but just kind of another another signal about how more assertive Japan is coming in the global security environment.
The great reporting from the Financial Times, Dimitri Stavastopoulos, talking about the Japanese joining Pillar Two of AUKUS to
AUKUS.
turn it into JAUKUS, which is something a lot of folks have, and certainly we've endorsed in the past as well on Prime Minister Kishida's visit to Washington.
Yeah, that's going to be a very interesting development if that happens. Now, there's still going to be a lot that has to get resolved, and we're back into information sharing and security, but it would be, I think, a very intriguing step. And of course, I think from a defense industry standpoint, well, what would that mean for ties between the different defense contractors in those countries? I mean, you already have an interesting one that's been developed between the UK, Italy, and Japan on the Global Combat Aircraft program. Obviously, the US has got a deep and long-term relationship with some of the Japanese contractors, but maybe like we're seeing in AUKUS, are there other smaller firms that might play a larger role in that kind of new ecosystem that could be developed? And it'll take some time, but certainly worth considering, and frankly, for some people, worth planning for.
Very briefly before we go to the vital National Defense Industrial Association's annual vital signs report that you talk about in your Monday note, just give us a quick Israel sense. Do you get a sense that
Look, I
anything
don't
is
know.
strategically shifting or not?
No, I don't. I mean, no, I don't. And I'm frankly been surprised by that. It is an election year, and I think whatever the Biden administration would do is going to be tempered by how that would play domestically. And so I'd be surprised if anything really abrupt or rash happens vis-a-vis Israel.
Interesting. All right, let's go to the vital signs report. This is really a nice taking of the temperature of the defense industrial base. A lot of talk about personnel and skills. Certainly a focus for any chief executive that's in this business for long term, because we did see a great retirement during the pandemic, which has driven up costs and delayed programs, whether it's in shipbuilding. We heard from that from HII's Chris Kastner last week when he spoke to reporters. What do you think the key takeaways were from the Vital Signs report this year?
I think, it's not a surprise, but it's just how difficult it is to hire. It's not just STEM people, but also cleared people and skilled trades. And, this isn't a new issue for the defense sector, but maybe I think, somewhat intriguingly is how long it's persisted and how long I think it'll continue to persist. There were some survey results that I thought really kind of called that out in the NDIA report. I think, people ought to maybe NDIA ought to be on your program to talk about it, Vago, because I think it is something that gets lost on Washington, D.C. a lot of times that, there's an attitude that industry can just, flick a switch, and but they can't. I mean, it takes time to hire people. It is a very competitive job market. Even the unemployment number, when it comes out, it's pretty low. Although if you look at how it varies state by state, there's higher unemployment in states like California, Illinois, New Jersey. Those also tend to be higher labor rate states. So it's something that I think industry is highly keenly aware of. It is, I think, a very significant inflationary factor for the defense sector. They are competing with the commercial sector as always for talent. But you know, as long as the unemployment rate remains relatively low, and you know, I suppose you could say, well, it is cyclical. You know, I put a chart in there that just showed the variability in the U.S. unemployment rate back to 1948. But you know, what kind of recession would you expect in 2026 and 2027? If does that free up people from manufacturing sector that might move over into the defense sector, or is it a recession that really hits more kind of the leisure, you know, restaurant, vacation type businesses? You know, is that something then that those people, if they were to enter the defense industrial base, you know, they're going to need more training, you know, to work in these plants, facilities, and they're going to need clearances. So this is, it's just a reminder that this stuff is going to take time. But I think it's also a very poignant reminder, since we're on the verge of another earnings season, you know, this is going to be a real challenge for defense contractors, and it's not going to go away soon.
So you expect to see, as we've been talking a little bit about, increased margin pressure on these companies, especially as subcontractors raise their rates, right? I mean, after having been squeezed for decades.
Well, there's a choice to be made, right? You could attempt to hold your operating margin steady, or actually try and improve it. You know, how you're going to do that is kind of intriguing. You know, do you just not pay people and remain competitive? Do you opt to shrink your business? You know, you can't outsource or move manufacturing offshore. Not when the Buy American provisions are actually, you know, calling for higher domestic content. So I think it's going to be a very interesting trade that managements in this sector are going to have to make, which is maybe you really do need to sacrifice some of your operating margin, what you're telling your shareholders you're capable of doing, if you're going to hire people, frankly, also maybe take away market share from the companies that can't staff up or deliver product on time or deliver services on time. And so I think it's just going to be a competitive differentiator. And maybe the company that doesn't strive for the highest margins, but the one who's willing to take their lumps, staff up, you know, retain really good people, it's going to be the ultimate winner, the long-term winner in this business.
We're going to go into a little bit of a lightning round. Really quick, why are we seeing performance among the major primes, right? Whether it's Boeing, Lockheed, and others down, and the services companies up?
Somewhat, I think, Vago, it gets back to that workforce flexibility, you know, that they are able, they may do more cost plus work. They're able to pass these costs on to DoD. You know, as opposed to a Northrop Grumman, for example, which, you know, opts to price, you know, the initial low rate production options for the B-21 program, the fixed price contracts back in 2013, 2014, 2015, you know, and then they have to eat those costs because the DoD doesn't have the resources, nor frankly, I think the sense of mind to allow contractors, you know, to get out from these fixed price contracts. So you just haven't seen those kind of charges or write-offs, these cost pressures. It's not to say they haven't existed in the services business, but maybe the services business, because of the weakness in the tech sector, I can't prove this, but maybe they are able to meet some of the higher demand that they're seeing, you know, with hiring new people.
Real quick, what are you looking forward to hearing at Navy League? Obviously, you'll be joining us next week, and we can do an after action on it. But what are your expectations? What are you looking for, especially as the Navy Secretary, right, targets his industry, which we're going to talk about a little bit with Chris and Chris.
Well, I'll just say, I think you guys talked about it with the two Chrises, but I just think it's really blockheaded move by the Navy not to talk about their ship programs, not after this report came out about the delays in submarine and surface combatants. I mean, it's just you're throwing away an opportunity to at least address the problem and talk about what you're doing about it, and have a dialogue with people about what needs to change, why did you get into this situation, you know, and instead to dog all your hatches, and just you know, keep any of the bad news from getting out. I mean, I think it's unfortunate, but the show, you know, what's new? You know, there are a couple of I guess the one interesting program for me is the submarine tender. That's a competitive program that should be decided, you know, later this year. You know, always on the lookout for what's going on in the unmanned space. You know, what are some of the new tech start companies bringing to the show? You know, FAX, that looks like it's moved pretty far to the right. So, you know, is there any thinking among contractors at the show or even the Navy about, so what are you going to do if you're now pushing on all these next generation systems? What's your fallback plan if you're not going to develop a new submarine or a new surface combatant in the 2030s? What do you do with the existing fleet? Are those new business opportunities that people ought to be thinking about?
And real quick, what should the audience be paying attention to this week, given it is a busy week?
It's one of those weeks where, you know, I think we're all going to take a deep breath Friday night, but you have Space Symposium in Colorado Springs. You have a bunch of oversight hearings in Congress on the FY25 budget with the appropriations and the authorization committees. The, you know, the Prime Minister of Japan's visit to Washington, D.C. is going to be interesting. What news is developed out of that? And then just the backdrop on, you know, you mentioned Israel, Gaza, what's happening with Ukraine, Russia. It's going to be a particularly busy spring week. Oh, and the World Bank is having their spring meeting, IMF World Bank. So that's kind of a step back, you know, at least look at some of the headlines. What are they saying about the global economy and commodities prices and interest rates? Because that all matters to defense spending.
And I should point out a great point, Byron, and just before we wrap, it's a good reminder for everybody. If anybody's going to be at National Harbor and has anything to do downtown, whether in the evening, a drink, a meeting in between or whatever, it's worth bearing in mind. Anytime the World Bank is in town, traffic is going to end up getting snarled anywhere in the center of town. So, Byron, thanks very much. Looking forward to spending some time with you over the next couple of days at Navy League, and certainly look forward to having you back on again next week. See you again soon. Thank you.
Absolutely, Byron.
And joining us today for a preview of the Navy League's annual Sea Air Space Conference and Trade Show outside Washington, D.C., that commences today and spans through Wednesday, the biggest jamboree for the United States Navy on an annual basis, and an ideal opportunity for leadership to deliver its messages to industry and the public, and ideally vice versa. Joining us are the co-hosts of our award-winning Cavas Ships podcast, Christopher P. Cavas and Chris Cervello. Gentlemen, thanks very, very much for joining us. It's going to be a busy week and looking forward to seeing you guys in person.
Likewise, Vago.
Yeah, thanks, Vago. Look forward to seeing you guys.
An absolute pleasure. Cervello, why don't you start us off, right? You're a retired Navy commander, graduate of the august graduate of the United States Naval Academy, and you're also, you know, part of our important part of our editorial team. And also the co-founder of the Provision Advisors PR firm. So, you know, a thing or two about communications. What is it you think we are going to hear from Navy leaders as somebody who is also a former public affairs officer? And what is it that we should be hearing, right? I mean, the Secretary of the Navy has already made clear that he's going to make delivery on ships and his message to industry. You know, I don't want you taking profits. I want you to start delivering. I've said this before. I'll say it again. The Navy, whenever it feels the pressure on budget and how it's spending money and the lateness of programs, throws industry under the bus. I don't think it's constructive, because this is a relationship that is more intimate than any manufacturing, you know, military manufacturing process in America. The Navy is involved in every step. The Navy is the one who makes the decisions. The Navy is the one who budgets for this stuff. When it slips carrier production, it drives costs up. We came out of a historic pandemic. There are supply chain challenges. The Navy actually has a tremendously good news story it should be telling in terms of industrial base investment that's actually creating more suppliers and giving them more resilience. Bull, start us off, right? What is it we're going to hear? What is it we should be hearing?
Well, I don't think we're going to hear a ton, Bago. And I don't mean to be negative, because I don't mean it in that regard. So the Secretary of Defense and the chairman will be testifying, as will senior Navy leadership will be testifying next week. I suspect that they are going to keep their powder dry. We will likely hear more of the same from Carlos Del Toro. We'll hear about maritime statecraft and the need to bring in more stakeholders into the maritime and what navalists like to call sea power. You know, we'll hear more about that. I think we'll probably get some backhanded pokes at industry. But sadly, I don't think we're going to hear as much as we are accustomed to hearing from the type commands, from the syscoms, you know, the types of things that the three of us like to get at these conferences, because I think there's this feeling, and I think it's a false feeling, to be quite honest with you, that you can't both talk at the conference and go up on the hill and deliver your message. If you've got it right, you're able to deliver that message cohesively at a number of different events across a number of different audiences through a number of different voices. But I don't know that the Navy's going to be able to do that. And so I think they will err on the side of caution. Now, what should we hear and what would I like to hear? And I would be super happy if I was wrong and this is what happened. We talked about it on our podcast over the weekend with Jerry Hendricks and Brian McGrath. I would love to hear the surface Navy and the aviation community talk about lessons learned and successes from the Red Sea. I would like to hear a little bit of swagger, not arrogance, but I'd like them to feel good about what they're doing and take away some real lessons learned about the positives and where they hope to improve in future conflict. From industry, I'd like to hear them push back a little bit on what the Secretary and what the Navy leadership has been saying publicly. And I don't mean to, you know, that they would argue or that they would say anything ill of the Navy, but, you know, we heard from Chris Kastner last week of HII, where he talked about the many layers of the supply chain and that this isn't just about the primes, that there are equal and opposite reactions to funding decisions that are made. I think industry needs to take time, whether it's formal or informal, and explain that to Navy leadership and the future Navy leadership that maybe doesn't understand the complexities of the supply chain, that doesn't understand that, yes, while sliding a submarine may make sense budgetarily, that there are equal and opposite supply chain reactions from tier two and tier three suppliers. And what does that mean for them? Those are important conversations that right now are getting lost in the headlines of Navy leaders poking industry in the chest. And then finally, I hope to see some new weapons and some new defensive systems shown on the floor. Chris mentioned on our podcast, he really hopes to see lasers and dazzlers and, you know, other counter UAS systems. I hope to see the same. I hope to see some of the fruits of the lessons that we've learned out of Ukraine, out of the Black Sea, out of Israel. I hope to see some of that technology. So a little bit of a long answer, but hopefully you can feel the excitement in my voice.
Yes, yes. I sense the anticipation. This is exactly. I don't even want to tell you which Navy League this is for me. It's going to profoundly date me. Kavis, your sense as an equal long time observer of the scene who's been living the dream.
This is my dream. I second every single thing that my partner Cervello just said. Roger all of that. I don't think we're going to hear a whole lot from people. It's too bad that we can't get the kind of program briefs that used to be regular and expected, especially out of Naval Sea Systems Command and Naval Air Systems Command. Just regular yearly updates on these programs. How's it going? What's new? What are you doing? The word has gone out. Don't talk a whole lot. And it's all implied, it's inferred, so there's no, you know, smoking gun somewhere, but it's definitely the word. You hear it from just way too many quarters. It's too bad. There will be a, for example, NAVC, there will be a brief on the, what's now called DDG Mod 2.0, which is the new upgrade for a limited number of destroyers. One is halfway through, two more have just begun the first half of what's a two phase. That's good. It's too bad there's not a program-wide update of the more than 70 destroyers that are in service, whose entry into service spans, you know, three decades. And by the way, are key elements in the war on the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden going on right now. It would just be, you know, they haven't done a brief on that program for years, and everything is out of date. They're not doing a brief on DDGX, the next service combatant, and everything is out of date. So the public, the problem with this sort of thing is like, oh, we don't want to tell the Chinese. Well, you're not telling anybody. So the public debate on a lot of these programs is just woefully out of date. It's just not dealing with, up to date information, which is really a shame, because I don't know, you know, who you think you're hurting here, but it definitely includes yourselves, I would say, to the Navy. That's too bad. The blame game, I think, will continue from the secretary. It's too bad that it's not a partnership mission. We're all in this together. We need to work together to improve shipbuilding. It's more, you know, the rant for the last few months has been, it's all their fault. It's all their fault. It's all their fault. And everybody has to get their game going. The partnership aspect has fallen by the wayside. I'm not sure I understand why that is the way it is. But we could talk more. And frankly, there are programs where they could talk about, and they've, by their own admission, that are not doing badly, where the problems are manageable and they're not key areas of concern. And by the Navy's own admission, this includes both amphibious ship programs, the LPD, amphibious transport docks, the big deck LHAs, the TAO program, the new fleet oiler program. It's under construction at GD NASCO in San Diego. And by the way, the DDG 51 Flight 3 program under construction at HII Ingalls and also at GD Bath Iron Works in New England. Right. These are not problem areas. So why don't you highlight some of that as well? It's not all a gloom and doom situation, but it's being presented that way. And if you don't pay attention, and most Congress people, you know, there's a lot of things they're supposed to pay attention to besides the politics and the noise from all that. But there are just dozens and dozens of issues. Most of them don't have time to get deep into it. So they just kind of, you know, they go by impressions as well. What's up with that program? Really, I'm not really sure. I haven't had time to look at it that closely, but my impression is it's just all screwed up.
Right.
And that carries weight. That absolutely, totally carries weight. They just don't have, they're human beings. They don't have time to study this stuff and go into depth. They have to pick and choose right. their topic areas. And these themes matter. They make a difference. And I wish that, the Navy has a lot of things that they could be highlighting that are not negative. And everything has problems. There's nothing that doesn't have a problem. Question is, are you managing it? Is it being dealt with? Is it getting better? Is it getting worse? And they rarely break that down. It's just like, it's all a mess. We have to fix all of it. It's all mess. Well, you know, is that really helpful? So I'd like to hear more of that. I also echo the thing, you know, the bit about the directed energy weapons. I'm wondering if industry will respond on the floor with the new SWO boss, Brendan McClain's comments at the beginning of the year, the first major naval conference of the year, Service Navy Association, where he opened up saying, where are my lasers?
Well, yeah, but I'm going to push back on that. Okay. They're very expensive. They take a lot of power. They're not particularly good for many of the things that we need to do.
Some of them are
specific applications it's very good at.
They're not all in that category. There's a whole family of them.
Right.
And,
I know.
And right. And yeah. the problem is that development of these things is sort of stalled. The priorities is not there. And you are correct. Some of them are very high.
And the physics are very bad for some of the things that we want to do, you know, especially in the Gulf and things like that. I know that, you know, his line is, I had him when I was aboard Ponce, but it wasn't particularly effective. So
I'll just be looking, you know, will industry, do they have more ideas that are not being used? I mean, it's a continually right. evolving technology, several technologies, and will industry have more to offer? I'll be walking the floor looking for that for sure.
Let me come back to you, Bull, before we wrap. And certainly we'll have you guys on next week to give us a kind of a recap as well. You know, from a particular standpoint, there are a lot of, I mean, first, the other services, to your point, right? I mean, there are hearings going on. the other services manage to have their major trade shows and hearings simultaneously. They will maybe avoid some of the pricklier parts of it, or take this as an opportunity to address the prickly parts with, right? I mean, at Air Force, you know, I think everybody could learn from the Air Force on this. The entire leadership is available to reporters at every single one of these big conferences. So much so, in fact, you have very little time for the show floor or even the sessions, because you're sitting in there listening to the folks and having access to them. From your standpoint, what are the good news stories that the Navy should be focused on? You know, when you know, Chris and I were there to hear HII's Chris Kastner, you know, he was very candid, very open about the challenges that the industry faces, but also highlighted the investment the Navy is making to try to actually build for that sustained demand that we know we're going to see in shipbuilding, with a ship construction and maintenance budget that's more than doubled in the last couple of years. From your standpoint, really quick, what are the good news stories you think that the Navy ought to be going out of its way to telling, as opposed to kind of the simplistic, well, obviously it's the Pacific, it's lots of water, we're in that business, thanks everybody, see you next week?
I think there are lots of operational good news stories. I mean, then you know, we talked about it on our podcast last week. I mean, the Navy made significant investments in time and money into people, programs, to up its game, you know, from the mid-20s to now. And I think you're starting to see the benefit of that in how the ships themselves are performing, but how the crews are performing. We're starting to see the loop is tightening between lessons learned, you know, in conflict and competition, and getting that back to exercises and training that the both the aviation, surface and sub, as well as other communities are doing. I'd love to hear more about that. I'd love to hear about the technology that they're using, the principles that they're using. I think those are good news stories. I think we're doing a great job working with our partners in the Pacific. I'd love to hear about that. And you know, there are a number of panels. I mean, there's no shortage of panels if you've looked at the if you've looked at the agenda. So hopefully that will come out, and we should feel good about that. And by we, I mean the folks that are in the Navy, the folks that are in the naval community and industry. I think there's an opportunity to talk about the good stuff that I just mentioned, and then there's an opportunity to talk about where we're not happy and where right. We need to improve. But I fear that we don't achieve that balance. And so therefore we want to sort of give canned talking points. And look, I'm guilty of writing hundreds of canned talking points over my career. But I, you know, I rely on the leadership to know what the audience is after.
I just have to say this, and I think I speak on behalf of many of us who say this, because we reporters talk about this all the time. Navy can do a lot better of a job at addressing and telling its story and addressing the hard questions, as opposed to sometimes trying to dodge them, because it's like, well, you know, you're going to ask us hard questions, and so we don't want to talk to you guys about it. And I just think that doesn't get you anywhere. And they should take some cues from the Air Force. They should take some cues from, you know, certainly the Army as well. I mean, I don't know a single Army conversation that doesn't end, or an Air Force conversation that's like, hey, but wait a minute, you know, you're falling down here. And over time, the more you engage, the easier it is to engage, and the more willing people are to listen to, okay, you know, I understand you're saying it, but hey, here are the facts. You know, how do we mutually get to a better place? Because I think we're doing it out of admiration and respect for what is, you know, one of the most important military services, you know, a very important service at a very important time. Guys, thanks very much again for joining us. Have a great Navy League. Looking forward to seeing you guys and interacting this week, and looking forward indeed to bookending it with you back on to sort of dissect what it is we picked up, both from leadership and the show floor. Fair winds following seas.
Thanks, Fargo.
Thanks, Fargo.